welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Absolutely. Pleasure.
So we'll get started where everyone else does. As far as earliest childhood memories, what are we getting into as a kid?
My earliest childhood memory is actually my sister being born.
Okay.
When I was like three. Let me think. Yeah, I was three years, 1 month old.
Okay.
That's my earliest childhood memory. But in terms of being an athlete, I wanted to be a pro rugby player when I was a kid growing up.
Okay.
And it was rugby. I started at 12. So I'd done taekwondo until I was like 12.
Okay.
And just kind of did this and switched. And then it was all rugby. I was adamant I wanted to be a pro rugby player. And nature and genetics was adamant I was not going to be.
So were we playing any sports when we were younger? What was our earliest sports that we played?
Yeah, so when you're in the UK, I think it's just accepted. Everyone plays football, soccer,
yep.
You know, at break time at school, all that kind of stuff. I think my mother actually had me doing tap dancing when I was three or four.
Yes.
Maybe a little bit older, but yeah, I did that. Taekwondo, did a little bit of basketball growing up. But yeah, I really just decided quite early on that rugby was for me.
Yeah.
And then,
so
you know, I did nothing else really from the age of like 14 to 30.
Yeah.
And then I was turning 31 when I started jiu-jitsu, which is why I have this lovely black eye. And messed up here.
my wife gave me a black eye once. Well, I think it was our second day of jiu-jitsu. Elbow was supposed to go behind my neck and my face got in the way. So, you know, that's just what happens. So when you were in school and stuff like that at the younger ages, were you playing outside with the kids a lot? Were you in the home? What was going on there?
Well, until the age of like 7, 8, where I was born, it was actually a purpose-built city.
What does that mean?
So like Memphis, for example. Memphis in the US is a purpose-built city. So it's not like, so for example, like London's 2,000 years old.
Right.
It springs out of nowhere, or like there's all these like smaller settlements that kind of like congeal into one city. Milton Keynes was purpose-built as like an overflow for London.
Gotcha.
So that was how my parents ended up there. And then the neighborhood that we lived in was... it started nice and then it went downhill. And like, you can Google that neighborhood today.
Yeah.
And there's like, you know, gangland executions and shit in that neighborhood. Yeah. Like literally people being shot in the back of the head where I grew up until I was 7. So the rule when I was 7 was you could only turn left. So you could go around the block like that,
okay,
but you couldn't off the pavement. So yeah, I mean,
was it dangerous when you were there?
I mean, there was a serial rapist in the neighborhood. Like I do remember like growing up when I was like 6, 7. I do remember like, I think it was like my dad and my mother having conversations about, hey, like, you know, you need to do this to be safe.
Right.
And finally, like, honestly, my dad got interviewed by the police. And because like literally like in this neighborhood, yeah, where we live, there was like a serial rapist. And I want to say this guy got caught like 15 years later by DNA.
Wow.
So they were like, oh, where were you at this time? And he told them, they're like, oh yeah, good. But yeah, that was like the neighborhood that I grew up in until I was 7. So there was not as much playing outside. But then once around that time, my grandfather died. So then the money that he gave to my parents went towards a house, and then we moved. And then after that, yeah.
Gotcha.
But
okay.
Listen, it sounds bad, but I don't know. If you ask me to live there now, I'd be like, ugh. But I mean, when you're growing up, you don't know anything else.
Yeah. Well, and like I've talked to a lot of people, if they come from like a war torn country or like whatever it is, like you said, like you dealt with it, you're a kid. Okay, this is what life is. Okay, like we're gonna make it through. That's what it seems like went on there.
Oh, dude, there's people that have it way harder than me. Like Mladen Jovanovic, you know him?
Who is that?
Mladen Jovanovic.
Nope, haven't heard him.
grew up in a war zone, grew up in Serbia during the conflict with NATO.
Okay.
Which is why I love it, because like he's one of the smartest coaches I know. Mm-hmm. And you know, a while back he was being lectured by a particularly kind of like left-leaning, right-on strength coach at St. Mary's, telling him about his white privilege. And I was like, bro, this guy grew up in a fucking war zone and you're lecturing him about his white privilege in his third language.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. I think it's tough that we've gotten to a place that we're lucky enough to where the words are the issues.
Yeah.
So I think that's a nice place to be for most people to have that be our issue. So we move out of that first town. Do we move closer to town, or like where do we head there afterwards?
Country, like village of 1500 people.
Okay.
Yeah. So then, you know, it's a lot more outdoors and you can go off and do whatever and stuff like that. So yeah, I was in that environment until I was like 18.
Okay. So well, let's say like the middle school, high school years. Do your parents want you to excel at sports, at school? What are they kind of wanting you to do?
Never any kind of push from my parents. A lot of support, but not a lot of push. So it's like that. What there was like, once you commit to something, you're expected to see it through. Like, oh, you know, it's Sunday, I'm tired, I don't want to go. It's like, no, get in the car. But in terms of like making choices, yeah, pretty wide open. Mm-hmm. But yeah, was not pushed. I think, you know, ultimately those kind of athletes burn out.
Yeah. I know a lot of gymnasts that end up that way. a lot of my friends that were gymnasts and their parents are like, hey, you got to do it. The coach said you can go to the Olympics. I'm like, ah.
Well, you know, it's such an attritional sport and it's such an early specialization sport.
Yeah.
When you're competing against countries where effectively their Olympic preparation looks like child abuse.
Yes.
You probably will not be able to match those countries and those athletes unless you have an adult with adult ambitions, an adult drive pushing everything forward.
Right.
Because kids for the most part do not want to train 4 hours a day.
Yeah. not ideal. So when did you get your first taste of rugby?
12.
And so was this a pickup? Was it on TV? How did you first get in there?
Now, I've been on TV, but like so growing up, I used to do taekwondo on a Sunday.
Okay.
And then when you grow up as a kid, rugby's played on Sunday, not Saturday. Mm-hmm. So like the adults play on Saturday, the kids play on Sunday. So that was always a clash. And then there was like, I think I went to watch somebody else play and they're like, oh, we need a player. Do you want to play? I was like, yeah. So then I played.
That's fantastic.
And I was like, oh, this is fun. You know, this is way easier than soccer. You just have to run at people as hard as you can. And then once I got to high school, obviously at school you play in the week.
Yeah.
So then that's when I basically started playing in the week. And then I started to double up and do club and school. And then that, you know, by the time I got to like 15, 16, taekwondo was gone.
Do you remember what position you played in your first game or how the first game went?
I was probably young enough that it didn't matter what position I played, but like I started out as a back rower. So, you know, not very skillful, just aggressive.
Yeah.
And then, once the height issues and size issues took over, I moved to hooker.
Okay.
And I was there until I was 18, 19, went to university and then switched to rugby league.
Okay.
Now I pretty much played rugby league at center for the remainder of my career.
So rugby league is once you're tackled, then everyone stands up and then it goes through the legs. Is that correct?
It is, yeah, but it's you generally speaking in attack, you want the attacking tempo to be as fast as possible,
right,
to force the opposition into like disarray, make them tired. And then in defense, you're trying to slow it down as much as possible. So if you stand up quickly, it's because they messed up. Like normal, it is a lot of work to stand up in rugby league. Gotcha. You just have to disguise it. Yeah.
Okay. And when do you know like the history on when those broke off or why they switched?
The 18 something at the George Hotel in Huddersfield. Okay. So yeah, it was basically with. Generally speaking, rugby, oh no, is it the rules that preceded it? Yeah, so basically, rugby union started as like private schools in the south of England where obviously you own the business, you don't need to ask permission to get time off work, you're going to make money regardless. There was a split in the north of England some decades later where in order to play the game, the factory and mill workers had to take a half day off in order to play the game. And they, because they were missing out on the money from work, yeah. they demanded to be compensated in the form of payment. And then because the rich people owned the sport of rugby union, they were like, oh no, it's going to ruin the amateur spirit and, you know, the Corinthian spirit, all this kind of stuff. So then they basically said, oh, okay, right. Well, we're going to break away and form another sport. So that's when the sport split. Okay. So rugby league has been professional for over a century. Rugby union, which is actually the more popular code yeah. worldwide, has only been professional since 1996.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Didn't know that. Well, the more you
officially,
know.
Officially professional.
The more you know. Yeah. So we're playing in high school. Are we doing anything else as far as like, do we care about academics or are we mostly just focused on rugby at that time?
I was good at them. I didn't necessarily care about them.
Okay.
Yeah. But I was, you know, I was pretty academic as a kid.
Mm-hmm. And was there any specific, you went to class and then you learned it pretty easily or why do you think you did so well?
Once it's in, it's in. Yeah, basically. Yeah. I never really took any notes, never really worked that hard. Mm-hmm. Like I honestly do not believe I ever worked hard until I was 25.
Hey, you know what? Building up. Building up.
Yeah.
So you said at 12, you're like, hey, this is something I really want to do. Is that when you said you wanted to play professionally or when did that start becoming part of the picture?
Almost immediately. Okay. But then, you know, by 16, it was in serious doubt just because of, you know, not big, not fast, not strong, not fit.
Did you start doing any training outside of the school or did you start hitting the gym at all?
Once I started to struggle.
Okay.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. So like 15, 16.
What did that training look like and where did you find those kind of modalities?
Well, I didn't. That was the problem. Oh. You know, it was all, you know, mental copy. Well, so probably like, yeah, men's health, bodybuilding magazines. This is like early days of the internet. This is over 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Then you start to get friends that, you know, I played with guys that played pro that, you know, did England age group, all that kind of stuff. So once you start to go to those rep teams, well, they get programs. So you're like, oh, right, let's all do Jeff's program. Yeah. That was a friend of mine, Jeff. And then another guy, Paul Diggin, he plays for England under 18s. He knows how to train. Let's just copy his program. So then a lot of that stuff. And yeah, I had like a little blip where I tried to do a degree in psychology because I felt like it was more worthy and more academic, which, you know, I did that for 2 months. And then after that, I rejoined university to do what would be called kinesiology in the States.
Okay.
And then, you know, I've been trying to find the answers ever since.
So psychology, what got you turned on to that?
I just find, you know, like people watching, I love a people watch.
Yeah.
And understanding about, you know, what makes people tick. Why do we do the things we do? I found it very interesting at school to do that. But then I found how it was manifested at undergraduate level to be very, very different. And I thought, nah, not for me.
So then you went going to kinesiology. Well, for as the American version. Are you playing rugby at this point in college, right?
Yeah, whole way through.
So do you get recruited to go play in school? Is it a walk-on? What's the situation there?
Oh, no, it's very amateurish in English universities. So there will be there's maybe, I don't know, 10 to 20 universities in the country that are like serious, serious rugby teams.
Okay.
And then of those, maybe two or three will compete in the national leagues.
Gotcha.
Where the, you know, the athletes are getting paid. I think, well, what happens is with professional rugby in the UK, you're basically signed to a club from the age of 12. So if you have, well, with soccer, it's four or five.
Also true. Yep.
If you find yourself at a university as a rugby player, you have already not made it.
Gotcha.
In effect. Yeah. So it's not like American sport where colleges are full of people waiting to take the next step to be pro. It's people that are already on the heap and just playing for fun.
Right.
And that was absolutely me.
Yeah. Well, it seems like basketball, football, and a couple other sports, but like when you get into baseball and hockey and a couple of those other ones, like they're maybe finishing high school before they go in those next levels. And I didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So
it was just for fun.
Yeah. So as far as like eating and stuff like that goes, you said you wanted to get stronger and bigger, whatever it was. What was your plan nutritionally while you were growing
up? There was no plan. That was one of the problems. I can train my way out of this. No, it's I just think it's a cliche where it's one of those things where initially you're like, oh, I just need to train and it's going to magically happen.
Yeah.
Then you go through the, well, I just need to eat more. And then you eat more and more and more and more. And you're like, oh, why am I so fat? Then you're like, oh, I need to eat like a bodybuilder. And you realize, well, actually, these people have orthorexia. It's not sustainable.
Yep.
And then you kind of like, probably I didn't get to the point of being like, I know what I'm doing. And I, you know, I'll pay respect to like dietitians that I know. I don't know what I'm doing, but I feel like, hey, this is manageable. It's sustainable.
Right.
I know what I'm doing until like late 20s.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. what did that look like when you first started figuring that out?
Remembering that I'm a human being and being reasonable.
What?
Yeah. And also it's like, this is a major problem that you see at American universities, which if you will not find for the most part, a strength and conditioning coach in American football that doesn't say, oh, he needs to gain weight.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'll look at it and say, oh, interior lineman must be 300 pounds to play in the NFL. You play interior lineman, therefore you must be 300 pounds. Slightly different ways of carrying 300 pounds. It's like you have to respect at some point and be a realist that
yeah.
your frame, like look at the width of my wrists. I'm never going to be 100 kilos. So you have to respect that there's a limit to what you can do.
Yeah.
And many an athletic career and a body has been ruined by trying to extend beyond those bounds.
Absolutely. I had a buddy, he played for the Dolphins for like a year, year and a half. And
yeah.
coming out of college, he's like, yeah, you're great, but we're going to need another like 40 pounds on you. It's like,
yeah.
He did not have another.
How 40. Do you want me to put it?
Yeah. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So when you start learning in university, what was so interesting that you first started learning about the body?
I mean, it's all interesting. I, you know, the basis of my business now is the fact that it's not all applicable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of gaps that are left by those traditional academic pathways. But the things that really appealed to me were the kind of like physiology stuff, anatomy, training theory, all that stuff. And then what I absolutely despised at the time was biomechanics, motor learning. And then the stuff that I think is probably much more important now is biomechanics, motor learning.
So what does that mean for the ones that have not taken those courses?
So, I mean, biomechanics would be the science and application of force to human movement.
Okay.
And motor learning would be basically how we acquire and then implement skills to solve sporting problems and how we develop in terms of our movement. Again, another problem with where I went to university, I had a great time, but does understanding how cerebral palsy impacts childhood development tell you how to train an elite level rugby player? No.
Gotcha. So when you say solving a problem for like a sport or something like that, does that mean the ability to shoot a ball and swing a tennis racket, or what do you mean by solve a problem?
It's all fractal.
Okay.
So the principles that that help you to solve small, highly focused individual problems operate at the team level as well.
Okay.
Everything is a problem to be solved. So if you can look at it at the highest level, what is the problem that needs to be solved? Winning.
Right.
How do you win? Positive points differential. How do you get a positive points differential? Okay. Score them in attack, prevent them in defense. How do you do that? Create and convert uncontested scoring opportunities, prevent them. Mm-hmm. How do you create and convert uncontested scoring opportunities? Space. Space equals time. How do you create space? Force, speed, misdirection. How do you create those? And it just keeps going and going and going. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, sporting skills are solutions that we come up with, permitted within the rules of the game to achieve those outcomes.
Okay. So would you put those sporting skills under athleticism or more of a skill?
Yeah. What's more important to the area of a rectangle, the length or the width?
I don't know.
One and the same. One affects the other. So okay. If you read a book called Complementary Nature, you realize it's not either or, it's one, it's, you know, something and they both affect one another.
Yeah.
So will more efficient movement skill increase force application mm-hmm. for a given level of effort or fatigue?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Does increasing force potential open up a greater bandwidth of movement skill or tactical schemes to you? Yes.
Okay.
And it just becomes a virtuous circle or a vicious circle.
So I have this question a lot. determining athleticism, obviously we have the combine for whatever sport it is, but when you switch somebody over to a different sport, how do you say we're doing basketball, rugby, football, and tennis? Is there a way to determine like a quality of athleticism through all of those sports?
No. Because it's like the whole, you know, if it looks right, it flies right.
Yeah.
If you are, I've had this conversation with someone about Patrick Mahomes.
Okay.
Patrick Mahomes is not agile. Why does he have all these linebackers falling off him then? You know what I mean? So you have to establish the lens through that you're looking at the problem through to establish whether an athlete is athletic.
Right.
You know, if on the one end you have what Mladen, who I mentioned, called the phenomenological approach. Does the race car lap the track faster than all the other cars?
Okay.
If so, it's a great race car.
Right.
If you put it in different situations, like a rumble strip, a skid pan, a drag, you know, tight cornering, stuff like that, it may be stronger or weaker in other areas.
Right.
So you, through the lens of, for example, handling, you might say, oh, this car's terrible. And it would be true, but it depends on the lens. And then you can go all the way to the other end and put a car in the shop and measure the brake horsepower, look at the gearing, look at the diagnostics. And it, again, there's going to be strengths and weaknesses. So the phenomenological approach allows you to look at everything as a whole.
Yeah.
Then you have the kind of like intermediate approach where you can look at strengths and weaknesses. And then you have the very kind of like diagnostic approach that tells you not just what happened, but gives you inference as to why it happened.
Okay.
And all of them have a time and a place, but ultimately you get paid for, does it go around the track?
Right.
Yeah.
So don't leave the podcast early, but I grew up doing CrossFit. So that's where we started. So they have the quote unquote fittest on earth towards their test. And I think if you're fine, because a lot of people can beat me fitness wise and CrossFit and stuff like that. But throughout the week when I would go play sports with them, I'd be able to go do basketball, tennis, and all the other sports, and it wouldn't necessarily transfer over. So I'm always trying to figure out how to determine athleticism, because they have a test for fitness, but I haven't seen a good overall test for athleticism.
Well, the reason for that is that, you know, sporting performance is comprised of four coactives.
Okay.
Tactical, technical, physical, psychological.
Okay.
So each of those is context specific. Those do exist in CrossFit.
Yeah.
So for example, having a more efficient, you know, handstand walk or muscle up or, you know, snatch, then you can have the tactics. Like, I'm sure you noticed big improvements early on in CrossFit by pacing, how to spend energy, when to work, when to rest, no physiological changes. And then of course there's the psychological stuff about concentration, understanding it's going to suck, but it's going to be over, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's very different to how those are expressed in a sporting context. So for example, you know, a backhand, a serve, thinking about placement on the court, where to stand on the court.
Yeah.
All these kinds of things. It's so different. Mm-hmm.
So like I have a Olympic style event where it's about like 120 events.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to figure out how to test that better, because it would take like a month to do all those things.
Well, that's when you start to come up with correlates, basically.
Okay.
So if you think about, like, go back to the analogy of the car going around the track. It's only useful to say, does the car go around the track faster or not, to establish, has the overall objective been achieved?
Right.
It's great if you say yes. If you say no, what do you do with that information?
Mm-hmm.
You don't. So you have to come up with this. It's called a forum for action. So what do we, not just what's the information, what do we do with that information?
Gotcha.
And that's when you have to start to go a level deeper. So if you think about that question within the context of team sports, the most specific thing you can do, like you said, is to test the sport itself.
Right.
It doesn't tell you what you need to do. So that's why within team sports, you have, and also every single game you play, the weather's different, the referee's different, the opposition's different. It's super hard to be consistent and to get, you know, reliable, valid information about, hey, this is what we need to do.
Yeah.
That's why you'll adopt an approach in team sports where you're testing things which actually aren't that specific. Lifting weights, jumping, sprinting, changing direction. These things don't actually predict to any meaningful degree who's going to be a Hall of Famer and who's going to be a bust.
Right.
That's why the combine is such a joke. They do the combine, they look at the game film and use the film anyway. But what it allows you to do is to isolate certain qualities that underpin performance in the sport and to measure them in a valid and reliable way.
Right.
So if you were to take, for example, Rich Froning and other podium finishers, who's the current man?
Matt Fraser. Yeah.
Yeah. There are going to be certain things that regardless of what the events are, they just smoke everyone out.
Yeah.
And it's those things that you know, like key performance indicators that you need to hang your hat on.
Yeah. No, and I would say for them, they both move very well.
Yeah.
If you watch a lot of the other guys, it looks like they're trying to push a little too much and they just seem cool and collected.
And you know what I find interesting? Like, I'm like I'll watch a little bit of CrossFit, like an armchair CrossFit fan. I have found that to be an elite level CrossFitter, just anecdotally, you need to have incredible outputs initially, like super high one rep maxes, in order that the events that you're testing in represent a smaller percentage of your overall max.
Yeah.
And the problem is when you're training CrossFit, when you're doing WODs every single day, you're never training in a focused, high intensity manner to really push up those maxes and get the benefit of that. So there's a lot of athletes in CrossFit that have trained in other sports or disciplines that have really pushed up those outputs that then transition to CrossFit.
Yeah. Well, it's really funny because I have a fair amount of friends that have done decent at CrossFit, but most of their training and off season or not towards competitions look more like strength and conditioning. Like they're not doing a whole bunch of Metcons. They're not doing a bunch of that type of stuff. It's just, they're trying to get stronger and maybe keep their skills, but most of it's just trying to get stronger.
Yeah. So I wasn't Matt Fraser. He was the son of Olympic figure skaters.
I believe so. Yeah. And he,
and then Froning was football and, I want to say a little bit of track.
Yeah. And the wild thing about Froning, I remember one of the documentaries, he's like, yeah, I just, after I get in a good workout, like I'm good. I can just keep going. And he was training like 6 or 7 times a day. I'm like, what is going on here?
I mean, the supplement regime may have been a factor.
Yeah. I think it was Advocare or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
A little spark in the water. So when we're going through school at that point, do you know what type of practice you're looking to have or what direction your life is heading at that point?
I knew I wanted to work in rugby, but it was when you graduate, you're kind of desperate enough to try anything. But if I hadn't have landed in rugby, I would have always been looking to land in rugby once I got a job. I just happened that the first kind of like internship that I got was in rugby. And then I was like, right, I'm not leaving.
Perfect.
Kind of like I've done in America. Like, right, I'm here. I'm not leaving.
So how did you find your first job? Was that through school, just putting your name out there?
Drew a 100-mile radius around my house on the map, listed every professional sports organization with 100 miles. And then I emailed them and they all said no. And then the next year I emailed them again. They all said no. And the next year I emailed them again. And one of them said yes.
Wow. Is that something someone told you that, hey, you should give this a shot? Or that's just...
Just me being stubborn.
So what did you do those 2 years where you got the no's?
Ate a bag of dicks. No, I was doing a master's degree. Okay. So... I was like, everyone's got a degree. I want to be special. I'm going to get a master's degree. And at the time I was, you know, like a garden variety personal trainer in a commercial gym.
Yeah.
And I made money that way. But then what I was doing was every time I was going for an interview, getting rejection and stuff like that, I would be the annoying guy that would pester them, be like, why did I fail?
Yeah.
And whatever they said, I would go away and work on it until it wasn't a weakness anymore. Then I'd come back and pester them again. And it was over that time that started to work more with athletes on a voluntary basis. Then it was like, oh, for a little bit of money, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And eventually just I kept showing up. And then the internship that I got, I was fobbed off from the senior team to the head of academy. And I'm sure I was the only email that landed on his desk, but I ended up interning for him. I spoke to him yesterday, actually.
Really?
He asked me to retweet one of the jobs he has with his company, and we caught up. And it's crazy, you know. Like at the time, he had a 4 or 5 year old daughter that used to come in the gym and do snatches with a broomstick. And he told me yesterday she's learning to drive now.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
So what was it like finally getting in? And be like, yep, you start tomorrow. What did you feel inside?
Elated.
Yeah.
Elated. Like I when I got to the point of having interns and assistants, I would tell them there's a reason they don't do internships at McDonald's. Because nobody wants to work at McDonald's.
Yeah.
There is a line out the door in professional sport because it is such a great environment to work in.
Okay.
There's downsides to every industry, and there's downsides to professional sport, but I think they're such that when you are younger and in a certain period of your life, you feel them a lot less.
Yeah.
So I tap dance to work every morning. Loved it.
So when your first day, are you just behind the scenes? Are you running anything? Like what kind of stuff are you doing as an intern?
I was lucky in that most interns, for the most part, interns, certainly in the States, and it was the case at the first pro team that I worked at, was still in college.
Yep.
Did not have a lot of coaching experience, like on the floor coaching experience. And as a result, I termed them house elves. You know, the house elves in Harry Potter, like you shouldn't see them. Clean this up, get this ready, do this, do that.
Yeah.
And I think their internship experience suffers as a result. Mm-hmm. I think it was an advantage. I think I had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder about it at the time, and people may have looked down on it, but I was 25 when I was an intern. But it was an advantage because I had spent 2 years coaching.
Right.
Sometimes personal training, sometimes athletes, but you know, a couple of thousand hours of coaching under my belt over 2 years. And I was probably in a little bit better of a position to capitalize on it. And then also because I was with the youth academy, you know, not with the pro team, you're allowed to make more mistakes away from you know, people watching
eyeballs.
So yeah, you're given more latitude to make mistakes, yeah. And on a smaller scale, which probably does not get afforded to you at the pros. Mm-hmm. So I, at that stage in my career, felt like a second-class citizen. And yeah, I'm sure other people looked at me that way, but it was a blessing in disguise.
So when they come to you, so you're working with the youth team, do they say, hey, we have these goals, do whatever training program you can to get them there? Or what is your job at that point?
The way that I would phrase it, there's a book called High Output Management.
Okay.
It's by the guy that ran Intel back in the day. And what he calls it is task-specific maturity.
Okay.
So I'll give you a real-world example. I managed a guy at my last spot who, when he came in, I was 33, 34. He was in his late 40s. He'd been to multiple NCAA tournaments, you know, a ton of experience, and interviewed like an absolute beast. And I basically said, do whatever you want. Here's the numbers I want you to track. Tell me how they go and then get on with it. Mm-hmm. If that was, you know, somebody who's just finished their GA ship, it's going to be different.
Yeah.
So me being at that stage of my career, not necessarily as tested, it was very much like, it's actually the way that I've tried to work with interns since. So, you know, for the first chunk of time, I'm going to do it and you're going to watch me. Then you're going to hold my hand and I'm going to give you bits to do. Then you're going to do it and I'm going to supervise you. Then you're going to do it and I'm going to check in with you. And then after that, you're going to do it. And I just want to, you know, look at the numbers. Mm-hmm.
So,
and I went through that progression fairly quickly, mostly out of necessity.
Yeah.
Because it was, you know, two of us for in excess of 150 athletes.
That's a lot of people.
Well, I mean, you know, under 12 to 21-ish.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are you working with these kids 5 days a week, 3 days a week? What does that look like? 2 days a week?
Well, yeah, there's like a dual pathway, or there was at the time in English rugby. I don't know now because I've been out of the youth system for 8 years. 9 years. But you, once you get to 16, we would partner with a local school or college.
Okay.
And effectively, that's the fast track to becoming a professional athlete. So you're finishing up your schooling, and then the day is split down the middle. In the morning, train to be a professional athlete. In the afternoon, go to school or vice versa. And that is 5 days per week.
Wow.
The other pathway is you have chosen not to go down that route, maybe because you go to an excellent private school. You are not old enough yet, or for whatever reason. And that would be 2 evenings per week for 2 hours at a time.
Okay.
Which is nothing. But what you have to factor in is that when you go to the full-time route, you are forfeiting playing for anyone else. So you are effectively a contracted athlete to that pro team. You only play for that team. That's it.
Wow.
If you go the other route, the biggest challenge with these kids is they're completely destroyed by volume. So yeah. If you go to a rich private school, these schools really hang their hats on the amount of physical education that they do. So you're doing 1 to 2 hours of PE a day. You're training with your local club team and playing for them on the weekends. You're doing the same for your pro team when they have games, and you're doing the same for your representative stuff like your county, region, and England.
That
huge amounts of physical exercise.
So what would a ideal situation, like what would you suggest that the kids do at that point?
It's not one or the other.
Okay.
To steal a phrase from a colleague of mine, the best athletes are the best athletes because they're the best athletes.
Okay.
So whoever is the best games player,
yeah,
what you want is athletes that are the best games players. Mm-hmm. You can select size, speed, strength for the most part. You can just like go out and say, right, you, right, you've got the frame for it. Come on
in. You can go get Carlin Isles.
Exactly. Carlin Isles sucks at rugby though. So, you know, you want guys that are absolute masters of their sport. That's ultimately what it boils down to.
Yeah.
However, there is going to come a time where there has to be specific, dedicated, focused training on one sport.
Right.
So it has to be a spectrum and a flow throughout the athlete's career. But what was clear at the time was that the full-time route, once that program started to become established, the proportion of the England age group teams that came from those programs just went up and up and up and up.
Okay. So of those 5 days, how often are we hitting strength, or what does the schedule look like for that 5 days?
It depends, like if you're in season or off season, preseason. But I think the most that we would have done would be like three or four lifts, just because as well, it's like when the stimulus of training is so novel to a teenage body,
right?
Why would you shout when you only need to whisper?
Yeah.
I
like that.
Then of course, like once you get into the in season, it's, you know, two or three in the thirds, just like pumping them up before a game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have a cousin that plays D1 tennis, and for professional athletes or for professional tennis players, they got tournament every weekend. Like the only time they get their rest is if they lose early in the tournament.
Yeah. It's, that is the challenge in professional rugby, which is honestly, most teams, your best performing athletes physically are probably going to be under the age of 23 because they've been training. They haven't necessarily been playing the amount of rugby that adds those miles to the clock. They're not carrying as many injuries.
Yeah.
And then you get that kind of like 18 to 23 where hormonally they're just a beast.
Yeah.
Once you get to 23, either you are going to be a significant player within your organization, or you're going to start to get spat out of the system.
Okay.
Once you start to become a major player in your team, then it becomes about the 7-day cycle of like prepare, recover.
Yeah.
That's when the numbers flatten out completely. Like if you find an athlete in their mid to late 20s making significant strides physically as a rugby player, they're either a bench warmer or something went wrong earlier in the career, okay, in my opinion.
So
yeah,
when you say 23, that's just hormonally wise, or is it that's what you're saying, recovery and stuff?
You get afforded, for the most part, unless you're a superstar, the opportunity to do a lot of training until you're about 23.
Okay.
Because you're going to be 20 minutes here, 30 minutes here. You know, the A League, which is the second tier system in the Premiership, is like 10 games a year. A full calendar, if you're a starter for a Premiership team playing in the European Cup, you might, and if you play for England, you might play like 40, 50 games a year. It's a lot of rugby.
40 or 50?
The Premiership campaign is 22 games. The European Cup, you could go all the way and play another 10. England's going to be another 10. Yeah.
That
you play a lot of rugby.
That is a lot of rugby. So how do you work on someone as far as how do you keep them around for those games? Like, what are you doing as their coach?
Well, you can train to develop, and again, complementary nature,
right?
Is athletic training about developing qualities or expressing them? Well, it's both, and it's a question of when. Is athletic training about the preparation and the long-term increase of underlying qualities, or is it about the freshness and the maximization, which is what can you do? What do you do? How do you minimize the gap between those two? One comes at the expense of the other. Mm-hmm. The great thing about training in the long term is it makes you better. The bad thing about training is in the short term, it makes you worse. Nobody is finishing a sprint session faster than when they started. Nobody is finishing a weight session stronger than when they started.
Yeah.
There's a time lag of when you reach that full fatigue and how long it takes you to get it back. Mm-hmm. And if you time that wrong in the season, it's going to bite you in the ass.
Yeah.
So what you have to do is flip the approach to training and understand that you're sacrificing long-term preparation for maximal freshness 1 to 2 times a week.
Mm-hmm. So if you're putting that into a schedule for somebody, what does that look if the game is on Saturday, starting Sunday, what's going there?
Sunday off, Monday low, Tuesday high, Wednesday off, Thursday medium high, Friday primer, Saturday game.
Sounds like you've done this a couple of times.
Some teams vary, like they like to do you can do on a Sunday and then have Monday off. Physically, you're not going to get as much good stuff done on a Sunday just because they're carrying that residual fatigue.
Right.
Upper body's about 48 hours to return to baseline, lower body 72 or more. Tactically, technically, the mistakes are a lot fresher in people's heads. So you can get them in and start correcting on Sunday and start preparing for next Saturday.
Gotcha.
Physically, you make a sacrifice. So it might be more recovery focused work than it is whatever.
Yeah.
Then you would go Monday off. And then the advantage of that is you get Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Some teams take a Wednesday off. In my experience, most teams take 2 days off a week.
Okay.
Sunday and Wednesday. But some teams like to go, like in American football, 1 day a week max. Tuesday is your highest training day. Tuesday is going to be like contact, strength. Wednesday is going to be your like speed and power day on the field and in the gym. Thursday is going to be a walkthrough, and then Friday you ramp up. Rugby traditionally is more contact on Tuesday, and then your kind of like speed team organizational stuff on Thursday, and then the captain run on Friday.
Do you have the wings and the front row and those guys like doing the same kind of stuff, or is everybody pretty individualized?
It's not individualized. Well, all the aspiration in all athletic training, and I don't mean like the people that take you up, I mean like training to be an athlete,
yeah,
should be right training, right amount, right time.
Okay.
And everybody is to an extent individual in their needs, but then you have to contrast that against, is it logistically possible? But if you just look at the pattern of activity in the game, the high intensity actions, what's the stuff that's fatiguing you? Backs will do about one sprint for every contact situation they hit. And by sprint, I just mean they're putting their foot down.
Right.
So not like an all out top end. It could be an axel or a change of direction. They'll probably have to do one of those for every tackle, ruck, maul that they hit. Mm-hmm. So it's a 1-to-1 ratio. And then it's a lot more intermittent in nature. For the forwards, it's 2-to-1.
Okay.
Yeah. So following that logic, forwards should dedicate a lot more time and effort and energy to mastering contact skills versus sprinting. Mm-hmm. There are going to be some commonalities. It's probably the dosing in terms of like frequency, volume, what risk distribution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whenever, so I played rugby for, I want to say 3 or 4 years. It was after competitive table tennis. So I had to step it up a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, we rarely practiced with the front row except for like scrimmages and stuff like that. So I didn't know if you guys did the similar as well.
Yeah. Well, you have, in terms of field training, you're going to have, again, it's the development versus expression.
Right.
Scrimmaging and team practice is wonderful for expressing the underlying tactical and technical preparation that's already there. It's not very good for developing the underlying skills. Mm-hmm. You say, like, in a game, international rugby, if you make 10 tackles in a game, good for you. If you do 20, that's a really good game. If you do 30, that's like outstanding. Mm-hmm. Is 30 of anything a week going to make you a master? No. So that would be like, oh, you know, we need to train. We need a dedicated block of tackling in this scenario, this scenario, this scenario. And the skills are very, very different. So what happens in pro rugby is that there's obviously team periods.
Yeah.
I'm football language. There's times when you train as a team. There's times where you train as your unit or subunit. And there's times where you train as like small group or individual. Mm-hmm. So the big difference, obviously, with the forwards is scrum, line out, probably kickoff, all that kind of stuff. And then with the backs, it's going to be like more attack.
So is this type of training very similar between all of the teams? Is there different stuff that you've been learning throughout the years? Like, does anybody try to throw in different things?
I think that the fundamentals do not change.
Okay.
It's more the organization of the pieces and maybe just like a little bit that you add in to mix it up. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, no. It's the same thing. Like, you could go to a cafe down the street. You could go to a Michelin star restaurant.
Yeah.
They have the same access to ingredients that the other does.
Yeah.
The difference is in the technique and the application.
Okay. So,
and the standard.
Where do you think you have improved from that restaurant down the street to the Michelin restaurant? Like, how do you think you've improved so well?
By no means a finished article, but my ability to consider the big picture and the moving pieces and to work backwards from the sport that I'm preparing athletes for.
Okay.
Because if you were to ask the average coach or athlete, do you agree that we should train in a manner that is specific to the demands of our sport? And they'll say, well, of course we need to train specific. And you'll say, well, okay, define the demands of our sport. They can't do it.
Right.
Yeah.
So was that something that one of your mentors told you? Is that something that you just saw happening? How did you get to that realization?
Yeah, a variety.
Okay.
You know, I've been, I just released a template yesterday for pre-order. And in the video, I talk about like, there's been these different groups of coaches that I've learned from. And, you know, I think what I learned from the Soviets and the Eastern Bloc coaches is like, in those stopwatch sports, you can measure whether what you're doing works.
Right.
And ultimately, did you add more weight to the bar? You're not measuring what matters.
Yeah.
It's, you need to work backwards from the sport, but then you also learn from, you know, guys like Charlie Francis, Buddy Morris, Joel Jameson, James Smith. It's the organization of training throughout the week that ultimately determines how productive it is. And then if you look at stuff like tactical periodization, and it's how that physical coactive fits into the broader context of the sport and that you're able to progress things in a logical manner. Mm-hmm.
So
to actually expressing it as improved performance on the field.
So when you're putting things into a template, do you look to a study and then with that study, you put that into practice with your athletes, or how do you come up with what you're putting into a template?
Ultimately, it's what works. So okay. Study for the, you know, the vast majority of the time is behind what's being done at the coalface. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't believe that steroids worked until the 1980s, thanks to research. So just because of the red tape that exists in academia,
right,
and the fact that for the most part, what academia says is, oh, look at that phenomenon. Let's try and investigate it to understand it and explain it.
Right.
The phenomenon they're investigating is what elite coaches are already doing to improve performance.
Gotcha.
So academia, I think it is very essential, is don't go down that avenue. Nothing to be found there. Hey, tweak this, think about this, and so on.
Yeah.
But it's mostly a validation or a refutation of what is already being done at the elite level.
Okay.
And what you have to do is also ask yourself, is this viable for the team that I'm working with, the equipment they have, the environment I'm working in? Mm-hmm. Do my athletes like it? Can I implement this? Can I coach this?
Yeah.
It really is like individualized.
Gotcha. So if somebody that's listening to the podcast is interested, who is this template focused on? Is it to the strength and performance coach to put towards rugby his athletes or?
Yeah, just rugby athletes.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, there you go.
So rugbystrengthcoach.com/big-template.
Awesome. So we did, you said 8 years in youth rugby, or it's been 8 years since?
Since.
Okay. So what was the next step after that for you?
Adult, just because, you know, I'd been going for a bunch of jobs and the feedback is like, oh, you don't have enough adult rugby experience. I was fed up with being treated like a second-class citizen, yeah, being paid like, so I was like, all right, time for adult rugby.
So what did you like about the youth rugby that maybe isn't as fun with the adult rugby?
You actually make a difference to kids' lives.
Okay.
Yeah. I am lucky enough that they're grown men now.
Right.
You know, like play for England.
Yeah.
That I coached them when they were kids. And I'm still fortunate enough to get, you know, calls and texts from them. I think that speaks volumes to the impact that you have on an athlete's career at that age.
Yeah.
Whereas like once they're grown men, you get a lot more prima donnas. They've already made it.
Right.
It's about what they want to do and you need to give it to them. So there's a lot less guidance and a lot less teaching, but there's advantages to both.
So when you're moving up to the adult, obviously there's a difference that you're working with, maybe less pliable. What does the training look like as far as the adults go?
Much more sport focused.
Okay.
Much more intense. Much more performance oriented rather than guided discovery.
Got it.
Yeah.
Are we ever hitting one rep maxes like that? It doesn't seem like it's super necessary, but I feel like kids and adults love to just throw those around.
I think for the most part, testing is wildly overblown.
Interesting. Okay.
Because if I gave you a book and said, I'm going to let you pick four random pages throughout the book, could you tell me the plot? The answer would be no.
Okay.
So, you know, does testing 3 or 4 times a year really tell you what you didn't already know? You could line up your athletes. I said, right, line them up against the wall, weakest to strongest. You could do that right now.
Right.
And then we could go test them. And the agreement would be like 95%. You know who's strong, you know who's weak.
Okay.
You can infer from the training process, oh, are the weights going up every single week? Yeah, you're stronger. Are they not going anywhere? No, you're probably not stronger. What happens if they're not in the mood or they're fatigued or the standard error of the test you're using exceeds the smallest worthwhile change that might actually make a difference? Are you inferring change or variability?
Okay. So
to get all of that information that you already had, you've wasted a day of training.
Well, and to that, I feel like usually it's a week of training because it's max week. And
for sure.
And then maybe we're going to deload for max week. So
you know why coaches test maxes?
See if they keep their job?
To justify their existence. Yeah. Yeah.
Wild. I mean, until you started saying it, it's like now that makes more sense. So when
why do coaches take fucking photos of their guys shirtless?
Yeah.
It's not, bro. There's some people out there that look like a bag of milk. Yeah. They do it to recruit athletes,
right,
to justify their existence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you're doing the if someone needs to get faster in the 40 or 20 or what, like sprinting, and like when you're using a stopwatch and stuff like that, do you just, you can tell if they're getting better primarily just from the training then?
No, I mean, it's not, I'm kind of being facetious. It's not as like eyeball test like that. What you're doing is, for example, when you're on a jetliner, you're on a long haul flight, do they just point the plane in a given direction for 2 or 3 hours and then say, right, check the map?
Right.
Oh, fuck, we're off course. No. They have technology embedded within the aircraft that they are getting constant, immediate feedback.
Right.
Small adjustment, small adjustment, small adjustment. That is what you should aspire to in training. So do you have technology, testing structures, all this kind of stuff embedded within your program that you're not waiting 3 to 4 months to get the bad news,
right,
which is the vast majority of testing in sports. It's like, do you, if you knew that you were going to make a mistake, would you want to wait 3 to 4 months to find out where all of your best training has gone for the year?
Yeah.
No, you'd want to know today or tomorrow. So it's this embedded testing. So for example, can I look at your raw acceleration data on a GPS to look at your rate of acceleration to infer if you're increasing your relative power? Or can I look at your top speed if we just run like a couple of fly tens in practice?
Yeah.
Can I look at the velocity that you lift a certain load with to infer strength in the gym?
Mm-hmm.
All this kind of stuff. Can we collect training data that just allows us to infer improvement rather than interrupt the training process to measure it?
So how, you mentioned the technology, the GPS, how has technology changed through strength and conditioning era for you?
The stuff that works is more user-friendly.
Okay.
And there's a lot more stuff that is unnecessary.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do we got that works?
Measuring heart rate,
okay,
HRV, measuring jump outputs, measuring force outputs, measuring speed.
How are you guys measuring HRV?
Well, when I did my master's thesis, I literally borrowed an ECG machine, got carbon paper, and then measured between RR intervals on a physical piece of paper.
That's not easy to use.
No, I really wanted to graduate and get it over and done with. Now you can get an Oura ring and measure it while you sleep.
So I have the Whoop, and right before, well, hopefully the podcast doesn't get shut down now, right before I got COVID, HRV just plummeted the worst it'd ever been. It said, hey, you either had a really hard workout the day before, which I didn't, or you're getting sick. So there it seemed pretty accurate. Are the stuff that you're seeing these days, is that stuff all fairly accurate?
I don't want to be harsh to Whoop, but like their readiness algorithm, I'm like, no. I understand. It's a question of sensitivity.
Okay.
Yeah. Can it pick up when you get COVID? Yes. Mm-hmm. Can it pick up when you're slightly fatigued and you need to modify training? No. What was the question again?
Well, I was just wondering on the accuracy, because for me, when I had the version before this, like my heart rate when I was doing hard workout or volleyball, whatever it was, I could hit the 180s, 190s, like that's hitting max for me. But now when I'm busting on like a 500 meter row, like we're maybe hitting 150. I'm like, that just doesn't seem right.
Yeah. I think, you know, a lot of the problem with these technologies as well is, in order to validate them in research, they have to open up the black box. And it's the black box that is proprietary.
Okay.
Yeah. So why would they open themselves up to the kind of scrutiny that would validate their ideas?
Yeah.
If it meant having to share. So they always do this research in-house, but
yeah,
you know, like Pushband, for example. Pushband got acquired by Whoop. And they were like, oh, you know, it's so accurate, blah, 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 blah. I keep mentioning him, Mladen, did a study. He put two push bands on the same bar, couldn't even get those to agree, let alone agree with a linear position transducer like a Gym Aware or, yeah, you know. So, yeah.
Like for me, I use mine primarily just be like to make sure I'm sleeping and how long.
Yeah.
And for me, that's what it's been most useful for.
Yeah, honestly, I believe the same is true of velocity-based training. The greatest value of wearable technology is the behavior change that you get regardless of what measurement comes out.
Okay. Yeah, that's where I've been with it, because at first I was like, ooh, I got to slow down my training today, but I feel great. And like, I would try to change my schedule around, and it's just like, nope, my Whoop says I should probably go to sleep soon. I should probably go to sleep soon. As far as the GPS and stuff like that goes, how do you get the information back? Is it just like a bunch of numbers? How does that work out?
I mean, it depends on how good the system is. Like, good systems provide you with a cloud-based platform to manage all the data.
Okay.
But then you can also get raw outputs. So I know a guy at the Seahawks who's like a, yeah.
That's his guy?
He's probably a genius, but like, he doesn't even want the platform. Okay. Like, he uses all of the raw output with code that he's written himself to present the data exactly how he wants it.
And through that, that's your radar, that's your direction real time. So that's the information they're looking for then.
Well, what you're doing with, or the fatigue that you create with athletes manifests itself in four different ways: metabolic, neuromuscular, structural, and then like psychological. So that can be cognitive and emotional.
Yeah.
Each of those flavors is associated with different types of activity. So if you go out for a jog, are you going to experience neuromuscular fatigue? Maybe a little bit, but really it's going to be metabolic and structural.
Yeah.
You do an intense match, for example, it's probably going to be everything, but it's really going to be like neuromuscular and psychological.
Yeah.
So what you want to do is try and have measures in place to quantify those efforts, and then also have valid, reliable assessments to infer that you're fatigued in each of those areas.
Gotcha. So when all this stuff is coming in, what type of changes would you make? Is this, we're at a practice and we're seeing someone's numbers are real low, do you send them to go recover? Like, what's the move once you get like red flags and stuff?
I can show you. Ooh. You want me to share my screen?
Absolutely.
This is actually from a long form course that I did for Strength Coach Network.
All right.
So this is Strength Coach Network Fundamentals Level 2. So the answer to your question is, it depends on the nature of the fatigue. Okay. And it depends on the extent of the fatigue. So
well.
Oh, okay, I'll just zoom in because it's got a voiceover. So this, the hierarchy of controls is stolen from industry.
Okay.
And basically it says, you know, the more intervention that you add in, the more you reduce the risk to workers. So if you imagine you work in a furnace, the best way to keep people safe from being burnt by a furnace is to remove the furnace from the factory or to have it completely automated would be a level down.
Yeah.
Or having them stand behind a screen so they're protected would be another layer down. Mm-hmm. Or get them to use tongs rather than their hands would be another layer down. And then let's get them to wear gloves and eye protection.
Gotcha.
So the more drastic the change, the more you reduce the risk you're exposing to the workers. Mm-hmm. So I looked at that and I was like, right, why don't we apply this to being athletes?
Yeah.
So the higher the risk which is fatigue, the more modification you need. So the smallest amount of modification would be preparation mitigation. Do you need a slightly longer warm-up?
Right.
Is there some kind of taping that we can do or protective equipment? You know, maybe you have a bruised heel or fat pad in your foot. That might be a change of footwear, for example. Mm-hmm. Load modification. Do exactly what you were going to do anyway with the mitigation, but just do less of it or slightly, you know, load it a little bit differently. What if that's not enough? Well, maybe we're going to put you in this part of the session, then we're going to pull you out of this drill and modify it a little bit for this part of the session and so on.
Yeah.
Or you say, right, you absolutely cannot do the session as outlined. What productive training can we do today that is not going to aggravate the kind of fatigue that you have and how fatigued you are?
Okay.
And then, of course, the last thing you do is actually say, listen, you're in such terrible shape today that no training is appropriate. We're going to remove you from training.
Right.
So based on what you have planned, you're going to have very low, low, medium, high, and very high training planned for a given day. And then you're going to have an athlete that would be very fatigued, normal, fresh, or very fresh based on standard deviations.
Yeah.
So if they're within one standard deviation, they're normal. One to two is above is fresh. More than two above is very fresh. And then the same on the low end. So if you have a very low intensity session planned, could be, you know, the boys got absolutely blown away at the weekend and it's game day plus one. Anyone can do that. So you don't need to modify it,
yeah.
Right? So at most, you might need preparation and mitigation if needed. Otherwise, completely as planned.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, if you have an extremely high session planned, full-on scrimmage, you know, heavyweight training, intense conditioning,
gotcha.
All that kind of stuff. If you are, you know, at death's door, you're probably not going to be, you're not going to be eligible to do any of that training.
Right.
And then it gets progressively less. So all we've done is just taken that funnel and applied it to all these different situations. And then you would also look at, you know, how can you prepare and mitigate for structural fatigue, psychological fatigue, mm-hmm. metabolic fatigue, neuro fatigue, and so on.
That's fantastic.
Load modification. I'm sorry, what was the question?
No, I was just saying that's fantastic.
I know. That's why it's $500.
So when did you start finding out that not everybody had the same knowledge or thought process that you've developed?
Everyone's different,
yeah.
But ironically, by looking outside of my own sport and my own country, just because, you know, the profit never comes from inside the village.
So when you would go somewhere else, would it be you talking to the other strength coach, or would someone come up to you and be like, hey, why are your kids performing so well? Or could you see it via that? Or
no, I mean, I don't think it was ever that, just because, you know, I never thought that my kids just blew other teams away. There have been times where my guys have been blown away and vice versa.
Yeah.
There's way too much going on to be like, oh, the strength coach is the reason. But, you know, my whole thing was like, I don't care what you did. If your kids are like blowing mine out of the water in terms of the metrics, I'm going to pay attention to it. And if it's not, I'm probably going to ignore it a little bit.
Right.
And then look at, you know, who's successful, who makes logical, good arguments, and then always questioning everything that's going on in training. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So when did you make the move over to the States?
2018.
Okay. So relatively soon or previously.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you start training the youth kids and then going to the adults, what does your training look like at that point? Like what are you throwing around?
I mean, I trained as seriously as you can as an amateur rugby athlete until, you know, pretty much the year that I quit rugby. And the reason I quit was just because I think I spent, you know, in excess of 26 weeks on the road that year. So you're not doing a lot of
wow
playing. Yeah. So yeah, like prior to that, I was just training as best I could to improve rugby performance. And then once I switched to jiu-jitsu, you know, as well with like my age, like I'm going to turn 37 this year. You have to accept if you do a sport like jiu-jitsu and you're in your mid to late 30s, the training must change.
Yeah.
Or nature's going to change it for you.
All right. So I'm early 30s. So I got some time.
Yeah.
So were you training, like what did a training week look like for you? Were you training twice a day? Was it once a day? What were you putting yourself through?
I mean, then maybe twice a day.
Okay.
At tops. Like right now I train 9 to 10 times a week.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll do jiu-jitsu 6 days a week and then I'll lift 3 to 4.
Okay. And while
you're then I'll have 3 days a week where I do 2-a-days and then the other days is just straight jiu-jitsu. And then I've like tried to do a bit more recovery stuff now, mm-hmm. just again, age and single parent.
So what does recovery look like for you and how do you determine if it's working or not?
Well, it's, I don't care if it works necessarily because it's like, you know, like the barber with the bad haircut, like my mother, after she finished teaching, owned a cafe.
Okay.
And she said, the last thing I want to do when I come home is cook a meal. Same thing. Like I'm going to go sit in the sauna because I like it.
Right.
I'm going to go for a walk outside because I like it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for the most part, the body follows the mind. If you're relaxed and you're feeling better.
Yeah.
For me at this stage of my athletic career, I'm not going to sweat the details, you know?
Right. Well, because I feel like a lot of people will like, oh, I need to stretch for an hour and then roll out and do this. And then they're still at the same place they are. So I didn't know if you had a...
Unless you are a pro athlete, you should do what you like and what you enjoy because you should do what you like and you enjoy because lifelong physical activity is a huge investment in your personal development and long-term health. Mm-hmm. And if you're a pro athlete, for the most part, you should do what you like and enjoy because it's better to sail with the wind than against it.
Yeah.
A colleague of mine, he's out on the West Coast now with the Navy SEALs, but he used to joke and said, he goes, nothing builds buy-in like making them hate it. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, especially in American football, like you have these teams building cultures where athletes hate to train.
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Well, I think Anthony Davis just posted, I haven't shot a basketball since like April or whatever it was. And people are up in arms, but if you don't like something, it doesn't matter if you're getting paid millions of dollars to do it. You don't like it.
I trained a kid, a tennis player at Richmond. He said, I never want to pick up a tennis racket ever again.
Tennis is a rough sport for the parents and the children. So right now, from moving to the U.S., what brought you here?
Wanted to work in the NFL.
Okay.
You know, I got to, in terms of rugby, got to a World Cup semifinal, fell a couple of games short.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, you know, I've done what I wanted to do in rugby. Now's the time to switch to the NFL.
So we're gonna wind that back a little bit. How was that journey to the semis?
Very fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very fun. Yeah. It took a long time and, I liken it to, you know, the final scene from Shawshank Redemption where he crawls through the river of shit and he gets up at the end. that's what it felt like.
So is there partying after the last game of the year? Are you hanging out with the guys? What's that relationship like?
It's kind of different with an international team to a pro team, a regular pro team in a domestic league. There is travel in the pros, but it's all pro, but
yeah.
There is travel at club level. But you're still for the most part going home every weekend, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
When you're in an international environment, you are each other's company. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more, bonding, living in each other's pockets. Like I would go out with play, you know, sometimes I would go out with players on a Wednesday on the day off, like go have lunch.
Yeah.
And with those boys, you know, I would kind of try and take one day per year, go out, have a couple of beers, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you want to keep that professional distance. But yeah, when we finished the World Cup, I got fucked up. But you know, the biggest thing I felt like we, in the quarterfinal,
yeah,
we were going against at the time the number two ranked team in the world. Mm-hmm. And after 13 minutes, we were 17-0 up. We put 40 points on them.
Woo.
And the overwhelming feeling that I had at the end of that day was relief.
Yeah.
Rather than anything else.
That's fantastic. So we head to the US. Was there already a job in hand, or what was the process there?
Yeah. University of Richmond.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, starting again at the bottom, I've said publicly, like the pay cut that I took to work at Richmond was over 200,000 a year. Yeah. that's how badly I wanted to work in the NFL, be in America, all that kind of stuff. So started again at the bottom, started learning football, and yeah.
So what was the conversation or interviews like when you found out that that's where you were going to have to start?
There was no interview process. It was basically given to me.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Which you would hope with that level of experience.
Does most of it transfer over? Not necessarily the position play and stuff like that, but the requirements. What's the biggest difference you see?
There's a lot of differences, but you know, all of these athletes have to run, jump, cut, try and take resisting opponents where they don't want to be. It's just the minutia, and then like the sport specific language.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. How has it been for the last 3 years? Have you been training through COVID, or how does that work out?
Well, I left the collegiate system in October 2020.
Oh. Well, okay.
So I'm full-time business now.
All right.
There was a variety of factors, but the COVID environment, I was just like, nah, I'm not doing this anymore.
So yeah. What was the, was it one day you were like, all right, I'm out, I'm going into business, or was it something that you'd seen coming from a while away?
The blessing of COVID was that it allowed me to focus on my online businesses at a time when everyone had nothing better to do with their time than spend money on online education. So I want to say the money tripled in 1 year and it more than doubled the next.
Hey.
So that was a factor. Being a single parent was a factor. What I was told the project was when I was recruited to go to my most recent school.
Yeah.
There had been an inkling that it was, you know, we'd been sold a bill of goods, and then COVID confirmed it. And I was like, well, I don't need the money.
Yeah.
I don't need the validation. I certainly don't need what it's doing to my personal life, all that kind of stuff. And I thought, right, now's the time.
Yeah. So
yeah.
So you said you're training jiu-jitsu now and stuff like that. What are what are your goals now that you're your own boss? Do you have higher aspirations as jiu-jitsu, or?
I mean, I'm probably just going to do it until I die. Just because human chess, you know, it's great to, it's great to do on a regular basis. And it's just one of those things where it's super infuriating to be beaten up by people. You look at them and like, how is this guy beating me up? But yeah, it's probably lower stakes, not as attritional as like striking sports or MMA. So
yeah,
I think unless you're being paid money to do it, it doesn't really make sense to do MMA.
Right. No. Yeah. I would agree. The amount of concussions that I would probably get would probably not be ideal for the wife.
Yeah.
So you mentioned nutrition a bit. What does nutrition look like for you right now? Obviously, you said you have to enjoy it to consistently do it.
Yeah.
What does the enjoyment look like for you?
Well, I have a tournament on Saturday. So right now I'm cutting back a little bit. So to be honest, I can do it now. I just don't want to do as much of a water cut.
Yeah.
But yeah, like moderate protein, relatively high carb, moderate fat. So like my daily, it's fairly severe cut in terms of energy deficit. But you know, I said I'm training up to twice a day and my calories is like 2000 to 2200.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm getting 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight, half the fat, and then about one and a bit of carbs.
What do you weigh? Or what do you...
Like 174.
Okay. How? Yep. So are we getting that protein in from primarily meat, or is it protein shakes? Or
yeah, meat, yeah. Although my fiance is a gluten-free vegan, so we have interesting differences in our nutrition.
What is a day of eating 175 grams? Cause I'm trying to hit 200 and like, that's hard for me if I don't start early.
Well, I think when you're trying, this is like one of those practical things that you learn when you are trying to gain weight, maximize liquid calories. When you're trying to lose weight, eliminate them.
Right.
Yeah. So, or it's like the, you know, like the mechanics of chewing and digesting.
Yeah.
Get rid of that. So like protein shakes, I eat a ton of fat-free Greek yogurt, like for you, liquid egg whites, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. And then you want to make it harder when you're trying to lose weight. So
I'm,
like,
I'm trying to cut down to 200. I'm like 210 right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I are you eating 4 meals a day, or how many meals are you hitting?
3-4.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
yeah, my big thing that I love right now is the carb balance tortillas.
Oh yeah?
yeah, because like, I got an air fryer as well. So I can make like a turkey and provolone quesadilla in the air fryer Ooh. With salsa for 300 calories.
That's not bad. That sounds tasty too.
Hell yeah.
I'm gonna have to break out. We have an air fryer / something else that it gives me an error sometimes, and I'm like, it's broken.
yeah.
So training for or getting ready for the tournament, do you feel that cutting weight, you come in with less energy, or do you feel like you do it well enough that you rehydrate and all that stuff is fine?
Depends on the interval.
Okay.
Like if you have a same day weigh-in, if I had a same day weigh-in, I would not be doing that.
Gotcha.
Yeah. It's the day before. So,
what would be, how much are you cutting before the tournament?
4 or 5.
Okay. And then you give yourself 2-3 weeks, or what's your.
No. So like the day before, I'll probably lose like 3 or 4 pounds.
Oh.
Yeah. That's it. Like, I probably walk around normally at like 180 to 185 pounds.
Okay.
And right now I'm just like 170. I was 174, 175 the other day.
Okay. And then you just got to get to 170?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So when you're training, I know a lot of people are like, oh, why don't you just like walk around at that weight, but you want to have more mass so you can train harder? Is that the idea?
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, the thing is like, if you're going against people that have dropped 10 pounds a day before in the 185 class, in reality, I'm walking around at 185 and going against guys that are 195 pounds.
Yeah.
Whereas I'll be that guy on Saturday, hopefully.
How long have you been competing in jiu-jitsu?
I mean, from the start. So I've been training almost 6 years.
Okay. What belt are you?
I'm just a terrible blue belt.
So do you guys do ankle locks and stuff like that, or is that is that just white belt tournaments that's not allowed? Or
no, I think you can like, it varies for the kids, but like you can straight ankle lock as a white belt. Once you go to no gi at blue belt, you can add in knee bars.
Okay.
And then it varies, like there's so many federations over here, but yeah, like advanced no-gi would be, you know, like heel hooks, toe holds, any kind of like twisting knee lock. Mm-hmm. But then in the gi, you're only allowed to add in toe holds and calf slices at brown belt.
Okay. So do you... So
until you get to that point, it's all just straight ankles.
Mm, do you train gi and no-gi then?
Yep.
So yep. do you... So COVID happened right before... or right as I started doing jiu-jitsu. So I just, yeah. I got mats and I've only had a couple friends come over every once in a while. Yeah. So the gym is, I think it opened up like a couple months ago. But when you're going into a match, do you have like a plan or it's more of like you said, chess? Because in chess, you have certain openings and things of that nature, but what is it for you?
Well, I don't consider myself to be a good competitor. Like I train with a guy that came, you know, third in the world at blue belt level, for example. Like he's much more like high level with it. Yeah. But I feel like you have to recognize what your strengths and weaknesses are. If you can try and steer a match towards your weaknesses and away from your strengths, that's great.
Yeah.
But then you also have to factor in like who you're going against. Mm-hmm. So like normally my preference is to try and stand and be on top. But then I've previously gone against a guy that had a D1 scholarship to wrestle. No time was spent on top.
Yeah. Do you feel, since your background of rugby and strength and conditioning training, does that give you a little bit of an advantage, an overwhelming advantage?
I have been told yes. just like pressure and squeezing.
Okay.
I'm probably going to squeeze people harder than a 170-pound IT worker. Yeah.
Fair enough.
But again, you know, I could go get beaten up by a brown belt tomorrow that's never lifted a weight.
Right. that's the unfortunate thing.
Yeah.
So in life as general right now, we're spending a lot of time training. As far as the online stuff, where do we see that going?
So I have two. Strength Coach Network is, we have an online education platform for strength coaches.
Okay.
To basically help them build the career that they want.
Yeah.
We exist to fill the gaps left by university accreditation. Those two. So we provide a lot of video lecture content presented by coaches that work at the elite level, career guidance and resources. So Q&As, interview preps, resume critiques, networking. We have monthly Q&As. We have advice in the business of coaching. So you can make yourself robust to the fact that financially it sucks for the most part. We also have the Strength Coach Network Fundamentals 1 and 2, which is like more, we say like the difference is it's like buffet versus tasting menu.
Okay.
Like we put together long form courses. It's like the, you know, here's exactly spelled out. Follow this to the T, and they complement one another. That's actually closed for registration right now until December.
Okay.
Alongside that, Rugby Strength Coach, which is player focused products and services. So, like I said yesterday, we just opened it up for pre-order. I called it cleverly the big template because it's literally everything that I would have done with professional and amateur rugby athletes.
Yeah.
And the goal with that is just to provide an insane amount of value. So, it's speed, agility, grappling, jumps and plyometrics, medicine ball throws, ballistic power strength, rehab, tempo training, high intensity conditioning, a testing guide, and there's 4, 8, 12, and 16 week variations, 2, 3, 4, 5 days per week, and it's $200.
Wow, that's a steal.
Yeah. That's what we're aiming for.
I've bought too many programs that I can't tell my wife about. But yeah, that is a very good price for what you're getting.
Well, so when is this going to go out?
I can put it out sooner. When would you like it?
If people order it before the 1st of July, if they use the coupon code BIG in all capitals at checkout, it's 25% off.
Awesome. We'll make that happen for sure.
Sweet. Thanks.
Absolutely. So, as far as your jiu-jitsu career goes, are you looking to get into big competitions or you just want a longevity of the sport?
Just longevity. Like, I think once, you know, if you're a single parent and, you know, you have a business and stuff like that, it's my ego can't tolerate sucking at one thing. So I would much prefer to suck at jiu-jitsu than be broke and a terrible parent. So
I think that's a good move. So to wrap things up, I want to end with the same two questions everyone gets. As far as health goes, not the dictionary definition, but what is health to you?
Like optionality.
Okay.
Can you do what you want to do when you want to do it? Like what I've tried to, you know, especially since leaving the collegiate system, which is, can I do what I want to do whenever I want to do it? And rephrasing that is like, can I go for a run? Mm-hmm. Can I go do this? Can I go do that? Like, I think that is a big part of health, because obviously when you're not healthy, those things get closed off to you.
Right. Absolutely. I love that. And then what's something from your life that the people listening to the podcast would be able to take away as a benefit?
Ownership is everything.
There we go. Awesome. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.